Education, Policy, and Finance Committee to order. Members, please take your seats. Okay. House File 3908 was before us last time we met. The motion shouldn't have been to lay the bill over, but the motion was to lay the bill on the table. I'd like to correct that now, and I'd like to state my opposition, well, actually my concern with the bill, and encourage committee members to vote with the chair. I move the bill to be taken off the table and be moving to lay the bill over. The motion is to take the bill off the table. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed? The motion carries and the bill is before us. I will move the bill to be laid over. Any discussion? The bill is laid over. Thank you. Okay, our first bill today is House File 3925, Representative Cleaborn. But first of all, we do have a quorum, and we need to, may I have a motion to approve the minutes for March 4th, 2020? Okay. Any discussion? Hearing none, those in favor.
Excuse me, Madam Chair.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, sorry, Representative Quam.
Madam Chair, I'm not seeing the minutes present in my folder.
Okay.
Someone has presented me the minutes. Thank you.
Sorry about that, Representative Quam. Is there any discussion? Okay, hearing none, those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? The motion prevails and the minutes for March 4th, 2020 are approved. Okay, thank you and welcome to the committee, Representative Cleaborn.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members. Today I am here to introduce House File 3925. It's my understanding that the bill is going to be considered to be laid over. I would just like to talk a moment about the bill itself. The bill is an appropriation of $250,000 to the Office of Higher Education for a grant to Avivo's Institute for Career and Technical Education. Avivo is a trusted nonprofit organization that increases the well-being of individuals by pairing chemical and mental health services with career education and employment services to help them achieve recovery, employment, career advancement, all the while also working to end homelessness. Avivo has served in the Twin Cities and in Greater Minnesota since 1960. Avivo serves nearly 13,000 individuals and their children each year and helps about 3,000 enter employment and lead to the careers to help them reach full self-sustainability. Avivo serves individuals and families who face the largest disparities and barriers to employment, homelessness, health, mental illness, substance use disorder, chronic unemployment, and poverty. Avivo is the only institution that integrates chemical and mental health services with career education and employment. Avivo's Institute for Career and Technical Education is licensed by the State of Minnesota Office of Higher Education and accredited by CARF. They offer 8 career training tracks for individuals to learn and earn industry-recognized credentials and credits. These credits are transferable to the MNSQ institutions of higher learning. It also helps them receive jobs. Avivo is seeking this $250,000 direct appropriation to increase the number of people that they may serve by providing the career training and employment services, and thereby increasing the number of jobs that can also help our Minnesota businesses fill their openings. And with that, Madam Chair, I would like to introduce our 2 testifiers today. And they are?
David Wilson.
Kelly Matter.
Thank you. And if you could say your association, that would be helpful. And then whoever would like, you can do that when you do your testimony. If you, whoever would like to start, that would be great.
Thank you. I'll start. Thank you, Chair Bernardi and members of the committee, and also to Representative Cleborn for chief authoring our bill. For the record, my name is Kelly Matter, and I am the president and CEO of Avivo. And as Representative Cleborn mentioned, Avivo is a 60-year-old organization that serves 13,000 people each year, helping about 3,000 individuals go to work. We helped over 800 individuals who experienced chronic homelessness last year get connected to housing. We provide services in four areas, really, substance use and mental health recovery, our school, our licensed and accredited school, education, employment, and housing and services to help end homelessness as well. As Representative Cleborn mentioned, we are licensed by the Minnesota Office of Higher Education as a post-secondary school and also CARF accredited for skills training services. Our school model is to work directly with and for business partners. We have a 200-member business partnership council that informs our curriculum, that speaks in our classrooms, that provides internships and externships for the individuals we are training, and most importantly, they hire our graduates. We help about 800 people graduate from our school in one of the eight different career pathways. About 800 go through the program. We have an 83% graduation rate, completion rate. As I said, we helped about 3,000 people go to work last year. We have an 83% retention rate at 180 days post-employment as well. As Representative Cleborn said, we are serving individuals who do have multiple barriers to success. Chronic unemployment, chronic homelessness, mental illness, substance use disorder, other disabilities, and barriers to employment. Yet, people are finding their way to us every single day to make a change in their lives, a change in their lives for the better, whether that be recovery, employment, a new career, or job advancement. I'm inspired every day talking and meeting with the people we serve. And really, in its most simple way, Avivo is working tirelessly to address three issues that are impacting our country and the state of Minnesota right now. We are working against the opioid epidemic. We are working against the labor shortage, trying to train individuals and work with business partners to meet that employment shortage, labor shortage, as well as the housing crisis by connecting people who are living in places that are uninhabitable, connect to housing. With the direct appropriation, what we hope to do is, I mean, we are going to serve people that otherwise would go unserved. Avivo is the only organization that is pairing our chemical mental health recovery with our school and employment services. We're not able to serve individuals in traditional workforce development funding streams, and that is why the direct appropriation, to make the right connection to the right service at the right time, so that when people are completing treatment, are ready to go to work, that we can connect them to training that gives them skills, that leads to jobs, that pay a higher wage towards self-sustainability, as well as earn a recognized credential in the industry and or credits that will also transfer to a Minsku institution so that they can further their education once they go to work and get that first job. So we are serving individuals that can work, that want to work, and it's just kind of making that connection at the right time for that. I think I shared all of the statistics. I won't review those again. But most importantly, Chair Bernardi and members of the committee, I think the outcome and the impact of our training programs and the support we provide is best described by individuals who have completed our program. So unless if there's specific questions for me right now, I would like to turn the floor over to David Wilson, who is a graduate of two of our Career Pathways training programs.
Thank you, and welcome to our committee, David.
Thank you, ma'am.
Mr. Wilson, excuse me. You may state your name for the record and proceed.
Okay, my name is David Wilson. I want to start with first thanking the committee and the school for making the opportunities that they made for me. There was one time I did not know where I was heading in life after 2017, I ended up having what they consider heart failure. And I did not know where to turn at the time. I was in Houston, Texas. I ended up here in Minnesota because my daughter moved back here. I was here before that. I also started the school maybe 6-7 years ago when they first started the class for maintenance custodial. I was one of the first students for that class, and it made a big difference in my life. I ended up getting a job at Geyer's Supplying Store, and I really liked the fact that they gave me the opportunity to work based on my disabilities and everything. The school made it really good and easy for me to do the jobs that I was able to do. Mr. Geyers loved my work so much to where he actually called me to the office one day and say, hey, you know, you make my job shine. We enjoy the work that you do for us. And he signed over and actually gave me a truck, you know, and I felt really, really good about that. So after I end up leaving Minnesota, going back to Texas, I end up at a hospital called Texas Children's Hospital. And the skills that I got from Adebo, it kind of made me shine also when I went to work for them. Only reason why I'm not working there now, because of my health fell, and I ended up having to come back to Minnesota. And once again, you know, the first thing I thought about, Dave, what is you going to do with your life? Where are the opportunities for you now? Because, you know, I couldn't hardly walk that well. I didn't feel like anybody would take the time out to hire me, give me a chance. Then I see someone mentioning the school again to me, and I was like, you know what? I want to go back there because the first time it turned out really good for me. So the second time around, here I am. I'm back again. I have another job working for the YMCA now, doing really good. They're really glad to have me there. You know, the skills that I picked up, again, the second time around, is paying off for me. And, you know, I don't regret it at all. It makes me want to push even more and more and try to help other people like myself and influence them to try to get different skills that could help them move forward and, you know, with their lives.
Thank you for your testimony. Okay. Members, do we have questions? Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And it was mentioned that your entity is around the state, so can you give me the Rochester location you work out of or office?
You know, we don't have a current location in Olmsted County or Rochester. We serve people from 17 counties across the state. Our school, the Avivo Institute, we have a location in the Twin Cities as well as St. Cloud.
Representative Quam, do you have a follow-up?
I like the intent. I like the entity, but for statewide activity, you know, the third largest city, there's a U of M, several MNSCU entities have courses there, several private colleges and universities do, and I do know that they do have a need for this type of activity. I'm just surprised that it isn't covered, and it'd be nice if we're going to do something like this to have something that did include a broader, you know, we've got 87 counties and just 17 covered.
Representative Cleavorn.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Quam. I really appreciate your understanding that there is a greater need for this service around the state. I think the piece that's exciting to me about Avivo is not only are they doing the classroom work that would give individuals stackable credentials to take with them as they pursue other opportunities, but they are also addressing the other personal needs, the chemical addiction, the mental health issues, the homelessness. And I don't believe that that is actually the role of our state institutions at this moment, but it would be something that we could certainly work together on going forward. But the money that Avivo could use today to help people tomorrow is something that we're looking at for this year. But thank you very much, and I'm more than happy to work with you on a bill going forward if you'd wish.
Mm-hmm. Representative Rumbach.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I'm wondering if we could just hear a little bit more about the types of career education courses that are available through your program.
Yes, we have 8 different career pathways programs, and those do change over time based on where, you know, the high demand industries are in our state. So we currently have a maintenance technician training program where people get a Class A boiler's license upon completion. They get a pool operator certificate and a floor care certificate and an OSHA certificate. We have a business and computer application specialist training program where people get their Microsoft Office and their A+ certification upon completion. We have a mechatronics training program that we operate in partnership with Dakota County Technical College. They come in and do the soldering certification, and people get credits that are transferable then to DCTC. We have a call center training program. We have a health information technology training program where we partner with local hospitals and people learn an electronic health record and how to work in an electronic health record. And I should have brought this sheet. We've got a basic accounting where people get their QuickBooks certification upon completion. And then we have a warehouse manufacturing program as well where people get OSHA certification, forklift certified.
Great. That's exactly what I wanted to know. That's wonderful. Thank you. Representative Lehman.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. This is probably a question maybe for the author and maybe for you. Just looking at the fiscal implications, and it looks like, looking at the bill, that we're allocating $250,000 in fiscal year 2021, and this is a one-time appropriation. It's not an ongoing appropriation. Is that correct?
Madam Chair.
Representative Cleavorn.
Yes, Representative Lehman, it is actually a one-year appropriation. We would like to take this bill next year for the next biennium into the jobs committee and not in higher ed. But for this year, we would like to have it in higher ed.
Okay, so that leads, thank
Lehman.
You. Thank mm-hmm. you, Representative Cleavorn. And leads me to you, to a question for the chair then. Obviously, this is a policy year, it's not a budget year. Would make more sense to come next year mm-hmm. with this request, or are we anticipating an allocation or a target out of the supplemental budget, or what are you thinking with having a fiscal bill in front of us this year?
We do not know yet, so we're getting this bill heard in advance, and we will find out. I'm not sure when those numbers are going to be coming to us, but there would not be enough time to probably have our hearings to be able to meet deadlines if we don't listen to them now. Okay. Ms. Matter, did you have a comment?
No.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Okay. So, okay.
Representative Lehman.
It's an anticipatory.
Right. Yeah, we really have no, okay. We have no indication what we're getting yet.
All right.
Okay.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
If we're getting anything. Okay, go ahead, Representative Cleavorn.
Representative Lehman, I always remain hopeful.
Other members have questions? Representative Rumbach.
Thank you, Madam Chair. When you're describing then the courses that are available, it does sound like, you know, it's very similar to a technical college. And so does that mean you're located in different geographies, or how do you partner with the technical colleges then?
Thank you for your question, Representative Rumbach. We partner a lot with other technical colleges. We're a bit different in that we are serving a population of individuals who don't find their pathway to the technical college. We actually help people eventually find their way to the technical colleges. And then we have articulation agreements with 4, working on 5 of our technical colleges so that people can earn credits in our school that will transfer to those technical colleges. And then we teach, we have a location in St. Cloud, we have a location in South Minneapolis. We teach classes at Catholic Charities downtown at the new Dorothy Day Center. We teach classes in St. Paul public housing. We teach these classes in high schools with transition age high school students with disabilities, so our school can go on the road a bit, if you will. You know, we're at Neighborhood House in West St. Paul.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Okay, I don't see anyone else. Do you have any, Representative Cleaver, do you have any closing remarks?
I would just like to renew my motion.
Oh, yeah, I forgot to ask. Is there any testifiers in the audience who would like to testify on this bill? Okay, excuse me for interrupting you. Okay, Representative Cleaver.
I would just like to renew my motion for 3925 and ask members to please consider this as we go forward. Thank you.
Thank you. So Representative Cleaver moves House Bill 3925 to be laid over for possible inclusion. Is there, the bill is laid over. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Representative Zhang. Welcome to your committee, Representative Zhang.
Hello, Madam Chair.
Oh, yeah, I'll have you move the bill.
Okay.
To be passed for possible inclusion.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I would like to move House File 4121 for possible inclusion into the bill. And as Representative David say, for inclusion, not possible inclusion, but
right,
I'm not
there you go.
As
so
bold
Representative
as him.
Zhang moves House File 2141 be laid over for possible inclusion. 4121, yeah, for possible inclusion. Please tell us about your bill.
Madam Chair, this bill is a bill that requires, that would require post-secondary institutions to include notations onto student transcripts who have either been suspended, permanently dismissed, or expelled for an offense involving sexual assault, or withdrawing from the institution as they're under investigation. And so this would be included into the notation, would be included into the academic record that's of the transferring student. And with me, I have two students and that will also testify on this bill.
Okay, yeah. Who would like to begin their testimony first?
Yeah.
Welcome to the committee and please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Chair Bernardi and members. My name is Sam Parmakar. I am the state government coordinator for the Minnesota Student Association. We're the undergraduate student government at the University of Minnesota Twin Cities, and we serve about 35,000 undergraduate students. And so House File 4121 is an important piece of legislation that would require colleges and universities to note on a student's transcript when they have been suspended or expelled for violating an institution's code of conduct policies concerning sexual violence. The violations covered by the bill are the crimes that meet the Federal Clery Act's reporting requirements: sexual assault, dating violence, domestic violence, and stalking. Any such notation made on a student's transcript would lapse after a period of 10 years or, in the case of the suspension, once the terms of the suspension have been completed. Additionally, any student who withdraws from an institution with sexual violence conduct charges pending would see a separate notation indicating that they withdrew while under investigation for a code of conduct violation. Transcript notation in instances of sexual assault is an important practice to ensure that students on Minnesota campuses are safe from sexual assault. We know that when a college male perpetrates sexual assault, it is likely that they will offend due to research on the subject. While suspensions, expulsions, and other disciplinary measures can help mitigate the risk they pose, perpetrators who are allowed to transfer without any documentation of sexual assault on their transcript may threaten the safety of other students at the receiving institution. This is not to say that all perpetrators will reoffend. We firmly believe in the importance and efficacy of restorative justice programs provided by university Title IX offices. However, we believe students with a history of sexual violence warrant higher scrutiny from admissions offices, would be prompted to contact a student's prior institution to learn more about the circumstances of their suspension or expulsion upon seeing this notation. This would allow admissions offices to make an informed consideration on whether a student who has committed sexual violence is ready to be part of a campus community again. Currently, it's up to each individual institution to set their own transcript notation standards throughout the state. Some schools, like the University of Minnesota Twin Cities, already make transcript notations in cases of sexual assault, but many other schools do not. A 2015 report from the American Association of Collegiate Registrars and Admissions Officers found that just 15% of institutions noted on a student's transcript if they had been disciplined for a Clery Act violation. Our current patchwork of institutional policy on this matter means that there is broad discrepancy in the standards that Minnesota students are being held to. Surely, on an issue as serious as sexual assault, we should set one clear and uniform standard that applies equally to every student within our state. This legislation is modeled closely after statutes that currently exist in New York and Virginia that provide for transcript notation in cases of sexual assault. Both laws were passed in 2015 after a number of high-profile cases where students who had committed sexual assault were allowed to transfer schools without a transcript notation and subsequently reoffended at their new institution. That same year, the Association of Title IX Administrators released a position statement in support of transcript notation policies. While media attention around this issue has died down since then, we still feel that this is a very important issue that our state has yet to address, and we feel that now is the time to do so. The legislature should pass House File 4121 to make sure that our universities are making informed considerations when an applicant has a history of sexual violence. This is a crucial step to making sure our campuses are a place where all students can feel safe and supported. Thank you, and we'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you for your testimony. Welcome to the committee. Becca Cowan?
Yes. Thank you, Chair Bernardi and members of the committee. My name is Rebecca Cowan. I'm a third-year student at the University of Minnesota Twin Cities. As a woman on a college campus, sexual assault is one of my biggest fears. I'm told not to walk alone, not let others make a drink, cover my cup, never leave my friends, and on and on. Alongside this fear, I put my trust in the University of Minnesota to do everything in their power to prevent further incidents of sexual assault. The UMN can and is taking steps towards prevention, but a major systemic fault outside their power is the documentation of this offense for prospective transfer students. While already practiced at the Twin Cities campuses, not all colleges and universities in the state of Minnesota indicate incidences of suspension or expulsion due to sexual misconduct. This greatly hinders the UMN's ability to prevent sexual assault, specifically with regard to reoffenders. With a statistic given from the university's Title IX office, of the 6% of college males who perpetrate sexual assault in college, two-thirds will offend five or more times. Guaranteed transcript notation allows admissions offices to fully evaluate an application and the risk of reoffending. In addition to prevention, this bill holds all college students in the state of Minnesota to the same standard. Under the current system, a student expelled from the UMN Twin Cities campus for sexual assault could apply to the MNSCU system with notation on their transcript. However, students suspended or expelled from our Duluth campus could apply to MNSCU without any such notation. It's an inequality within our system and a risk that we're applying to various students. This bill takes a step to align the repercussions for sexual assault across the state, in addition to holding all transfers in Minnesota to the same code of conduct standards. Thank you for your time, and I strongly encourage you to vote in favor of this bill as a step to reduce the widespread fear on college campuses, protect students, and provide consistent, adequate information to college admissions offices on this issue.
Thank you for your testimony. Representative Rumbeck.
Madam Chair, I guess we're at the questioning.
Yep,
questions
right,
point?
Yep.
Okay, thanks. Reading.
I threw that up. Sorry. Thank you, Representative Rumbeck. I need to ask if anyone else in the audience would like to testify on this bill. Okay. So you may proceed, Representative Rumbeck. Thank you for letting me interrupt
Madam
you.
Chair. So the offenses are, the penalties are expelled, dismissed, or suspended, okay? But, I mean, those are based on, aren't they based on allegations? And I don't know if there's an actual court process on the campus But, I mean, you're treating allegations as if, you know, there's been a conviction, it seems to me. And so the individual, you know, has that kind of a black mark, that it really is, you know, been through a court process and a judge and a jury and so on. So I guess how can an allegation sort of rise to that level of really, you know, impairing somebody's future?
Mr. Parmakar.
Yeah, thank you for the question, Representative Runbeck. So just to clarify, the notation would not be made on the basis of simply an allegation alone. So the notation is made once an allegation is made, the student then goes through the university's disciplinary process, which is already outlined for code of conduct violations. And then if the university decides as part of that disciplinary process that there is enough evidence to for them to find that that student should be either expelled or suspended, that is when the notation would be made. So this bill doesn't alter the circumstances of how a university decides to adjudicate violations and the punishment for those. It simply says that when a university makes that decision, it needs to be something that's shared on the transcript.
But Madam
Representative
Chair,
Rumbach.
And Sam, Mr. Malter?
Parmakar.
Okay, so, but you, I mean, you're more or less saying that your code of conduct process is the equivalent, has the equivalent of meaning of being a court. I mean, and does the student have, you know, an attorney? Is there examination, you know, opportunity for him to examine his accuser? All of the things that are necessary, right, to have a good court system.
Ms. Cohen.
Yes, so in the university's investigations within the code of conduct, we do have an office of student advocates. So students are kind of represented in giving consultation throughout that process. Additionally, on the burden of proof with these incidences on college campuses, it is around 75%, so it is higher than a civil case, which is 50+1, but not quite where a criminal conviction is. At the same time, on these transcripts, it's not saying there was a criminal conviction filed, it's simply applying to the code of conduct on college campuses. And this code of conduct is pretty consistent across the state of Minnesota for things that they would suspend or expel students for. So it doesn't go all the way to criminal, but there is a very high burden of proof for these things to be indicated.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll listen. I'll keep listening.
Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I have several questions for the bill author. I just want to first clarify, did I understand correctly that it's when a student is under investigation that the notation could also be added to the transcript?
No, it's it's under the statute. It's when they are suspended, permanently dismissed or expelled for an offense that which involves sexual assault.
Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Okay, so then, based on the line of questioning that Representative Rumbeck was discussing, I do have concern whereby this investigation would occur with student or with school staff that isn't necessarily law enforcement. So when there's a law enforcement investigation, and if there's a sexual assault, you have professionals that are going to be investigating such an incident. In this case, is there any prescriptive language in here that those that are investigating are law enforcement? Is there a requirement for that?
It would, Madam Speaker, Madam Chair, sorry. No, it would be under the school administrative system, and I think the student can speak a bit more about the process too.
Yeah, and so Representative Lucero, just to kind of me, Madam Chair. So like Representative Zhang said, again, we're not seeking to indicate any sort of criminal conviction. I know that the university has its own process that is prescribed by state and federal law for how these cases are adjudicated. I can't speak in depth to what that process is. I don't know if anyone is here from the university that wants to speak to that, but from our understanding and our conversations with various administrators when we're getting this bill drafted, our understanding is that it is a very thorough process and there are a lot of professional parameters that need to be followed. And when a university decides to suspend or expel a student, It's a pretty high standard. It's not something that's done very lightly, and it's only done when there is substantial evidence to suggest a student's culpability.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Representative Lucero.
Thank you. Okay, so then based on that and to the bill author, is there circumstances or do you have examples where a school may have taken action to suspend, dismiss, or expel a student that they have deemed have committed a sexual assault, but that doesn't get prosecuted by law enforcement or county prosecutors?
Madam Chair, Representative Lucero, not to my knowledge.
Mr. Paramar.
So in doing research as we were developing this bill, we did find that in 2015 specifically, there were a number of high-profile instances around the country where a student had been dismissed for a sexual assault violation, they had transferred, and then they had reoffended at the new school that was not aware of that history. So I don't have that written down off the top of my head, but I'd be happy to send those along to you and Representative Zhang if that's helpful.
Okay, thank you.
Anything else? I do have a few more.
Sarah.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Okay, and what the intent of my question in that particular case was, if there are cases where the school is deeming an action to be true, but then law enforcement is not prosecuting or investigating those cases, then that to me causes creates huge red flags with this legislation because it means that the school is taking action that can have a detrimental impact on students that professional law enforcement doesn't deem to have the equivalent evidence, right? That's a huge concern for me because of the high potential, obviously, of stigma and adverse impact. When I'm hearing 10 years, 10 years from, let's just say somebody's average age of 20, we're talking 30 to the age of 30. From the age of 20 to 30, as we know, that is the prime age when people establish their life, make decisions, get their first job, get their housing, right? And if there's something on their record that law enforcement hasn't deemed to be accurate and or hasn't been prosecuted, worthy of prosecution, think of the ramifications that can have on a person. And then where are they going to end up once they hit 30, right? I mean, this, in my opinion, flies in the face of those that are pushing ban the box, right? They're seeking to hide what employers is visible to them, right, in terms of their criminal history. They want employers to be blinded in some cases. I know that there's a push when it comes to landlords. So Madam Chair, my next question for the bill author would be, as a landlord myself, I don't now, but this might be interesting, an interesting piece of information if it were to become law. If I, as a landlord, were to require, in addition to employment history, criminal background history, credit check history, if I were to begin requesting from tenant applicants their school transcripts, would I be permitted to deny somebody housing if they had this on their transcript? And there was no other information anywhere else. No criminal history, didn't show anything. Mm-hmm. It simply was this. Could I prohibit them from renting to them?
Madam Chair, Representative Lucero, for that, I couldn't answer you. This is for college campuses. And so with that, I'm not familiar with housing law. But now,
I just want to mention we're laying over the bill, so if there's stuff that is outside of our committee that would need to be worked on, maybe that could happen after it is now. And I don't know if we have anyone in, if there's someone in the room that has the technical expertise to answer that question. Is there?
Madam Chair.
Okay, go ahead, Representative Lucero.
Thank you. And so along that line, the next question was going to be, I mean, I as a landlord context, but how about employers, right? I recall not just the first employer when I graduated college, but it was the first couple of employers, several employers, that wanted me to supply them with my employment application, a copy of my transcript. So could an employer deny somebody if there was nothing else? There was no criminal conviction. There was no... the drug testing, all of that was okay. An applicant passed every other method of screening, but could an employer deny, because employers are going to see it in the transcript, and if this is on the transcript, could they deny somebody a job based on their school's transcript and having this notation on there, having not been found guilty by a court of law or investigated by actual law enforcement?
Okay.
Representative.
Madam Chair, Representative Lucero, well, I think let me be clear with the what the notation on the transcript would actually say. Is it on the on section on subdivision two? You know, the language would say that the student was in violation of either a student code of conduct or something. It would not necessarily say, you know, the student was in violation of sexual assault. And so, I think it would have to be up to the employer to see that. And do you have anything else to say?
Mr. Paramar.
Yes, so just to expand upon what Representative Zhang was saying about the actual language and the notation itself. So we are not with this bill proposing any sort of new process of transcript notation. Transcript notation is currently a widely used practice at many colleges and universities, and most often it is made, like if a student commits plagiarism, that would go on their transcript. And so schools are already making transcript notations, and the language in the bill itself is not going to say on the transcript, so-and-so was expelled for sexual assault. It's going to say, so-and-so was expelled for a violation of the University of Minnesota's code of conduct. And it is then the responsibility of whoever is reviewing that transcript to contact the Office of Community Standards or the equivalent institution at a university to learn more about the circumstances of that student's dismissal or disciplinary action.
Okay, Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And I do want you to be able to ask your questions. And if you could do one more, and then we'll move to other members and then come back, that would be.
Very fair. Thank
you.
Okay, so that brings up a good point then. I do recall as part of this process that as an applicant to an employer, I had to release my transcript. And so I'm just thinking the scenario. So I'm an employer. I received the transcript from the school. It has this notation. It says, I'm not seeing anything prescriptive in here exactly how it's up to, as I'm reading the language, it's up to the school to determine what the verbiage is going to be on the transcript. So under the scenario, the school or student has been suspended or expelled for a violation of the code of conduct. Okay, so I have that much information as an employer, and here I am looking at this transcript. With that release authorization, do I as the employer have the ability then without further consent to dig in? Because I would want to know as an employer, well, what exactly, if they were expelled for a violation of rules, I now want to know what that was for. I could either ask the applicant or do I have the ability to obtain that information without further applicant permission?
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative Lucero, in those situations, I think that it would fall under the similar parameters in which an employer would seek information on student transcript or make a transcript request. I'm not sure if every university, like difference between a public and a private university, what the process would look like. And I think you might have something to add on to that.
So, Mr. Paramikar.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for raising that point, Representative Lucero. That is certainly something that I think we do want to clarify moving forward, and I don't know that I have a definitive answer to your question right now. What I would say is that while I think an employer would be able to ask any sort of applicant to explain, hey, like, what's this on your transcript? I do think just off the top of my head, there may be some sort of FERPA regulation on what a university's Office of Community Standards could share with someone outside of the higher education system, but I'm not certain about that, and we'll certainly look more into that.
Okay, thank you. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I understand your intent is for student safety, but I'm seeing a glaring omission in that faculty and staff are not included in this, especially with, you know, you're looking at under investigation. Now, I know there have been multiple recent things about, you know, K-12 administrators and teachers moving job to job, and then, you know, finally, you know, things come out faculty-wise. Once you go on investigation, the process is fairly lengthy, and I could see the same susceptibility of faculty or staff hopping to another job and new students that could be exposed to this behavior, why does your bill not address notification when they send a letter or make a call to say, you know, confirm that this person worked there, that they left while they were under investigation for violations of conduct, you know, a similar type thing? I would think that would just be logical, reasonable, and prudent to have that included in your bill. So I'm just trying to understand why it was omitted.
Mm-hmm. Representative.
Madam Chair, Representative Quam. I just want to clarify your question. So you're concerned about the omission in notification of to the person that is alleged of the conduct, or to the other universities?
Representative,
sorry.
Thank you. I'll try and clarify.
Yeah. Yeah, and if we could stick with the contents of the bill, that would be really helpful.
Madam Chair, okay. This is straight to the intent and content of the bill. The bill is to protect students.
Yes.
The bill is to prevent predators or bad acting students from going to another campus and putting those students at risk. So why does this bill not include faculty and staff in the same type of notification and protection for students that you have on the, you know, for students and transcripts? I would think that would be a logical thing to do, and is fully in line with the intent and actions and components of this bill. So that's what I'm trying to find out, is why is that not included? And possibly you could include that to have it more thoroughly and completely affect what you want to come out of the situation.
Mm-hmm. Representative Zhang.
Madam Chair, Representative Quam, yeah, I agree with you. Student safety is something that it's important, but I think the how this bill had come about was addressing student transcripts, and so you know, as teachers, they don't necessarily have transcripts, and so that's was the scope of this bill. But I would be more than happy to work with you on a bill like that.
Oh. Thank you, Madam Chair, and I would appreciate having the opportunity to improve it so that we do more fully and not have an omission of you know, better protection for students. Thank you.
Representative Poppy.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and just to this point, Representative Quam, this is a bill about student code of conduct and a transcript that a student earns while they're a student at a college or university within the state. It's different from what you're suggesting. I'm not saying that what you're suggesting is not an appropriate thing to do, but I'm a little confused about how that's entering into this conversation. But my I do have a few questions or comments. I think one, and I'm sorry that I did not get an opportunity to talk to you, Representative Zhang, before this bill came forward, but you know, a lot of what this is being suggested might actually be more appropriate for the Minnesota state system, because as was stated, you know, in the bill, the University of Minnesota system, we can't really tell them what we're asking them to do. And from what I heard one of the testifiers say, that maybe the Twin Cities has one set of internal policies, and Duluth might have another set, and Crookston another, and Morris. So I'm wondering if internally, and I guess this would be for the testifiers, what have you done internally that helps to make more a smoother transition between the state university system that we have here in Minnesota?
Mr. Parmakar.
Well, thank you for the question, Representative Poppy. And you're right. So the university does have constitutional autonomy from the state. So the language in the bill does simply request that the university comply with the language. What I will say is that in our conversations with administrators at our school, and you're correct that the University of Minnesota Twin Cities is already making these notations, what we heard is that a part of the problem that exists is that there is such inconsistency at different schools around the state. So we believe that if this legislation passes and you're having the Minnesota state system. You're having private colleges all adopting the same standard. That then creates an incentive for the rest of the University of Minnesota system schools to move towards that same standard so that there is consistency and there's not all of this confusion being created by the differences between different standards that universities are using for transcript notation.
Representative Poppy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for that answer. I guess I would encourage you to maybe look within the University of Minnesota student organization system to try to bring that uniformity. That would be good. That would be done at the university system. And through the Minnesota state system, I know that what they currently have is the ISRS system, and eventually they're going to have the next generation, next gen system. And I'm not sure, I guess I don't know if anyone from Minnesota State is wanting to talk on this, but I know that notations are done electronically, but they're not necessarily, so the notification is given kind of from college to college, not necessarily on the transcript, and I'm not aware of what notations are on the transcript, so I think that would be something to get more clarity on whether or not you know, I applaud the intent here and the idea of making sure that we have safety for our students and that we're dealing with problems when they arise and making sure that we are addressing this very serious issue, sexual assault issue. But I'm I'm just trying to think process-wise how we might better develop that system. And so that would be, I guess, just a statement on that. And then a question, another question I would have, and then I think this will be my last one, Madam Chair, is if a student is found guilty of sexual assault but not on campus, so they are, spring break is happening, students are back home in Idaho, and something happens and the university is not made aware, the college is not made aware, and then they come back to school, kind of just the logistics of how that works, where some students, and again, sexual assault is a serious issue and we need to address it when we can, and I'm just trying to figure out how that works, where some students maybe would have that on their transcript, where other students maybe wouldn't, but they might have done something similar, but it wouldn't have been on campus, it would have been off. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Mr. Parmakar.
Madam Chair, Representative Poppy, thank you for that question. So my understanding from the conversations we've had is that if a conduct violation were to occur outside of the university's jurisdiction, then that would not be something where they would be empowered to prescribe any sort of disciplinary measures towards.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Franson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, I have serious reservations about this bill, too. Like Representative Poppy said, sexual assault is very serious, and we don't want to minimize it at all. I just, you know, in today's world, we see from a national level of accusations that take place in order to destroy a person's a life. And, you know, under this language where there's really no due process except, you know, through this school, that the allegation is so serious for a dismissal or an expulsion, but not serious enough to attempt at a criminal prosecution first before the transcript notation. It does concern me. We could have a student that, let's say, something happens between two students. Student A is very upset, so decides to, you know, say something happened. There was an allegation. So student A goes and makes the report. Student B doesn't know anything about it because it was just thought they were just breaking up or there was really nothing, you know, it was a relationship that was never going to move forward. And then knowing that there needs to be some sort of history in order for the transcript to be notated, then student A gets their friends to make some other allegations that took place. And before you know it, we have a case of student B being expelled, suspended from school with a scarlet letter to follow them for 10 years without being able to clear their name. That's what I kind of envision. And also to the comment of women not being able to walk alone, I'm 43 years old. I don't walk alone myself. I don't trust anybody. If I have a drink, I don't just leave it there. I think that's good practice for anyone of any gender to practice that safe. Should be no shame in not being able to just leave your drink on a table and walk away, make sure somebody's watching or covering it up. I was just watching, doing a little bit of Crime Watch Minneapolis, and I certainly would not be walking alone in Minneapolis myself. Just on Sunday, there was a report of a person with a gun and a male assaulting a female. This is the world that we live in. We always have to practice, make sure our boundaries are taken care of and practice safety.
Representative Gomez.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess I just wanted to say a couple of things quickly. I have a bill that lifts the statute of limitations on reporting sexual assault that was heard in the Public Safety and Criminal Justice Reform Committee. And this, we had a day of bills that were about sexual assault. And I guess I just really feel the need to just say quickly that this idea about like an epidemic of false accusations of sexual assault to ruin someone's life is just simply not supported by the data. They estimate that 3 to 8% of sexual assault allegations are unfounded, and which is exactly the same rate as you would see for any comparable felony at that level, which is terrible, right? But I don't think that, the reality is that very few women make it through their lives without being the victim of sexual assault. And for a lot of us, it takes like time and space to reckon with it. And there are barriers at every step of trying to report and hold someone accountable for sexual assault. Sexual assault is one of the most widely underreported crimes. It is the, evidentiary standard often means that it's, to your point, it's very difficult to discern from a sort of a objective perspective whether a sexual act was consensual or not, which is like the question when we're asked that when we're wrestling with this issue. And I just think that it's very important that we, understand that there is a there's a culture around women's bodies being the property of men, and that's been embedded in law for many years, and even after not being embedded in law anymore, the reverberations of that still exist in our society today. And certainly, if people don't feel comfortable like being in places at night, that's cool. But I don't think it's cool to send the message that if you are someone who walks around at night, that you kind of like are going to get what's coming to you. And that's the implication, and those are the messages that women receive in 100 ways, large and small, from a sort of a world where sexual violence is pervasive and where many of us have to deal with it in our lives. Any time that you have something that's like could be considered systemic violence, which I believe, violence against women is is systemic violence. So it's on a continuum. On one end is the reality that a woman is more likely to be murdered by someone who loves her than to die of pretty much any other cause. I mean, that's not exactly true, right? But like, if you're dying of a violent crime and you're a woman, it's most likely someone who at one point loved you who's killing you. Women are like statistically less safe in their own home than they are walking in a war zone in a far off land, right? And if we were in active war in Afghanistan, you're less safe in your own home, according to the statistics. And so that's like one extreme of systemic violence against women. And then there's sort of like this continuum, and there's sort of things that seem innocent when taken in isolation on this end. Things like saying, oh, you know, you shouldn't be walking around alone at night, you shouldn't be wearing XYZ, you shouldn't like get drunk, you shouldn't, you know, you're not allowed to like make a decision when you've said yes to certain things, you're not allowed to say yes to other things. Those statements and those sentiments exist on a spectrum with severe violence and death that women experience disproportionately. And so I guess I just would caution us to like examine when it is that we're contributing to that reality that women live with. And, you know, I mean, just to the underlying bill, I mean, like I said, there are so many barriers to reporting sexual assault, to having an allegation taken seriously by an institution, investigated thoroughly, and holding a perpetrator accountable. It's a very, very difficult process. And so I just feel like when we can provide more accountability and more justice to survivors of sexual assault, that we should take those opportunities to do so. And so thank you for bringing this bill forward, Representative Zhang.
Representative Lean.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Can the bill's author or either of the testifiers talk a little bit about what other types of offenses or campus violations are reported on transcripts? I know you had briefly mentioned plagiarism. What are some other instances?
Mr. Samikar. Mm-hmm. No, Parker. No, Sam Parmikar.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Lean. Absent a state statute mandating certain transcript requirements, it is up to individual schools to determine their own policy. So I can't speak to the specific policies of every school throughout the state. I do know from research that it is somewhat common for schools to make notations in the case of plagiarism, bad grades, other sorts of academic violations. I don't recall hearing any instances, in the instances where a school would make a notation in the case of violence, like some sort of assault more broadly, they would also be making them for sexual violence. So I think there are schools out there that do have those policies. I don't know which specific schools they are.
Representative Lean.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So was this bill in any way structured based on, you know, and that's fine if you just want to refer to the Twin Cities campus. I get that that's where you go to school. Mm-hmm. I get that. So if you just want to talk about your knowledge with those specifics, you know, I understand that. Was this bill in any way structured based on what you know the U of M Twin Cities campus does in terms of how they're noted, you know, that 10 years for a withdrawal if a student is under investigation? Are there similarities to that in existing policy for U of M in the Twin Cities?
Mm-hmm. Mr. Parmikar.
So our consultation with administrators at the U of M came after we came forward with this idea for the bill. So the original bill idea was modeled off of those statutes that currently exist in New York or Virginia. So when we were drafting the bill, we weren't necessarily basing it off of U of M Twin Cities policy. As part of the research we did, we met with numerous stakeholders at the university, so our Title IX office, the Aurora Center, which is our resource center for victims survivors of sexual assault, Office of Community Standards, the President's Initiative for the Prevention of Sexual Misconduct, and others. And based off of the feedback that we received from those groups, we did make some tweaks to the bill so that the 10-year period you're referencing was based off of feedback we had received for administrators after we had the first version of the bill drafted. But the bill itself was not crafted to mirror current University of Minnesota Twin Cities policy.
Representative Lean.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So are there instances then at the U of M Twin Cities where something like this would stay on somebody's transcript for 10 years if they withdraw, while the case is under investigation?
Mr. Harmon Carr.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't know if the University of Minnesota Twin Cities has a time limit on these notations. That was just based off of the feedback we received on how we could make this bill better and not have that be an indefinite notation.
Representative Lean.
Thank you, Madam Chair. These other states that you referenced, when you did some research on this, do they also have that 10-year window for, the withdrawal under investigation?
The other state statutes that exist, I believe, have indefinite notations in the case of expulsion, withdrawal, and then with a suspension, if the terms of the suspension are not resolved in a suspension. I believe there have been other proposed bills in other states, as well as the federal level, that do set a time limit on a notation. So I know there was a piece of federal legislation introduced a few years ago that would have had a one-year time limit. But this 10-year time limit that we came up with was based off of feedback from experts in our administration on what they felt would be the best practices moving forward.
Representative Lean.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll close with just a comment then. I certainly understand what you want to do, and I commend you for doing that, for wanting to make your campuses safer, other campuses around the state safer. I think it's very unfortunate that a lot of times in these instances come up, people rush to judgment on both sides of the story, both sides of the case. And I think because these instances are so sensitive and so emotional and have such long-term, possibly have such long-term repercussions for people, we have to think very clearly about this. And the 10 years, because of a withdrawal, to me, that does give me some pause. I can just think of an instance where something may have happened, he said, she said, he said, he said, whatever the case may be, that while this was under an investigation, somebody could withdraw just because they were like, I'm done with it. This is too, I can't go to class, I can't study, I can't get my projects done. People around the campus, they look at me differently. I just can't do it anymore. And even if an investigation was carried out and was found that there was no wrongdoing on anybody's part, that student would still have this negative mark on their transcript. So I just think we need to be very careful and think very clearly about these sorts of policies. I certainly understand what you want to do. I support what you want to do, wanting to make campuses safer, wanting to make students safer. But we just, I think, have to be very careful, and this is a good way to start this conversation, I think. I guess, if anything, I would just leave that maybe more work needs to be done to get some consistency around these sorts of policies in terms of what is already in place and in terms of what can be done at other campuses. So, thank you.
Mr. Parmakar, did you have a...
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for your comments, Representative Lean. So to your point about a notation being made in the case of a withdrawal, so when we had this bill initially drafted and we're collecting feedback, that was a point that many of our stakeholders had raised, and we kind of went back and forth on whether we wanted to include a notation in the case of a student who withdraws while under investigation. And I certainly hear your point. We don't want to be wrongfully attributing blame to a student that has not been officially found to have violated an institution's code of conduct. What I will say is that the transcript notation itself does not explicitly impute guilt. Rather, it would simply say, this student withdrew while under investigation for a code of conduct violation. And so the receiving institution that sees that transcript, that office of admissions, would then be contacting that previous university to find out the specific context of the that student's withdrawal. So obviously each case is going to be different, but if there was a context where, say, a student had withdrawn due to a mental health concern, that would be something that could be clarified by the two institutions talking to each other. And I will speak to our reason for wanting to include the notation in cases of withdrawal. So it's our concern that by eliminating that provision, you would create a pretty wide loophole wherein a student who is accused and they've committed this violation and they know they're going to be suspended or expelled for it, simply withdraws from the institution instead and therefore doesn't receive that notation and is free to transfer schools without this important piece of context being included on their transcript. So we were just really wary of removing this instance and creating this really broad loophole that we fear could be exploited by people who wanted to avoid a transcript notation.
Okay, Representative Rundeck.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So we've heard that there's different codes of conduct for different campuses. And, I mean, that there in itself sounds, very, very, very difficult. I mean, it's a compromised system. You know, you're guilty in one campus, you're not guilty on another campus. But I wonder if we could take a look at the campus codes of conduct. Is it possible to receive, maybe, Madam Chair, asking you that? Or a sample? How about a sample?
Great. I think it would
be very instructional.
Like which institutions were you think?
Well, we could maybe St. Cloud, Moorhead.
Cloud and Moorhead.
Yeah, I don't know.
Okay.
Yeah. Mankato. Yeah. Handful.
Okay. We can.
Mm-hmm.
And then maybe
the U of M.
And if we get a response, we will share those with the committee. Thank you.
But Madam Chair, I would love to hear from the U. I mean, I got to believe that this opens them up to a lot of liability, parents suing, saying that their student was wrongfully adjudicated and so on. So, will there be lawsuits and are we prepared for that?
We actually had an answer to your question that I went to have shared with you. Mr. Williams.
Chair Bernardi and Representative Rumbach, I was just mentioning to Chair Bernardi that there's system-wide policies for the University of Minnesota system and the Minnesota State system, so I can pull those up and potentially just email them to the committee members if that would be helpful.
Okay, very good. Thank you, Mr. Williams.
But do we have, Madam Chair, a comment from the university or one of the other institutions
about this
bill?
No one wanted to testify. I mean, no one came down to testify. Okay. I did offer testimony to anybody.
All right.
Okay. Representative Quam.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And this bill is about student safety. The mechanism is the transcript. Mm-hmm. I just think there should be additional mechanism, and that would probably require allowing the sharing of from one personnel department to another, say if they were offered an interview, and then you'd be able to see, because both have the same privacy protection for people, it's not public, and they're used to looking at, and that way a notation would be visible, they could have a discussion, it doesn't prevent being interviewed. I had done a bill a couple years ago for this, allowing this in the more of the K-12 range, but we could implement the same thing, because if we truly want to improve student safety, we should be complete. Mm-hmm. And I will work with the author to try and come up with more mechanisms to more thoroughly and completely cover this issue. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Lean, did you have?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, I was just thinking about Representative Quam's comments and concerns, and maybe it would be worth having the two systems, I don't know, maybe the private schools if they would like, to review what is included in people's employee files, personnel files for professors, staff people, maintenance people, because that may address some of those concerns that Representative Quam has. So, thank you.
Okay, seeing no further questions, would you like to make any closing remarks, Representative?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to thank the two students for stepping up to the plate and taking on this enormous task. I know they've had numerous of meetings with administration, with legislators, and I know it's not their first time coming here, too. And so I just want to thank you both and your courage for taking on this sensitive topic.
Thank you. And so, Representative Zhang, would you like to renew your motion?
Yep.
Okay, Representative Zhang renews his motion that House File 4121 be laid over for possible inclusion. The bill is laid over. The meeting is adjourned.